than everyone else. But Hank always said he looked like a tough guy, but he had a marshmallow heart, I'll tell you. He was.
He had a great record in World War II, though, and so he had a sort of reputation as being a
tough guy,
tough Marine. And
absolutely.
Talk about the off-field role. That is, what is the role of a manager in keeping 25 players? Now, some of them are older, some of them are kids. What do you think a manager's role is in the off-field area?
Well, I just think a manager's got to make sure the guys are ready to play. And, you know, I don't see you having too many restrictions. When you get to the big leagues, that's the top of the game right there. And if you want to, I think that most of the guys realize that if you want to prolong your career and you have to take care of yourself. Of course, there's always guys who abuse that, and I've seen a lot of guys do that, but I've also seen players that really took care of themselves and ended up prolonging their career for many, many years. But a manager really can't supervise off-field activities. He just has to go by what happens at the ballpark. But I think there's a lot of telltale signs that you can see if players are abusing the privilege that they have.
Brooks, one of the tragedies of baseball is baseball's relationship with alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean, over the years, you and I know dozens and dozens of players, some great players, who have hurt themselves by just being real abusers of alcohol. Can you talk a little bit about that? The culture, I gather, the players really seldom speak to each other about it. If you had a player on your team who was just drinking heavily and not performing, talk about what your response would be and your attitude toward these guys who were drinking so heavily.
You know, a lot of guys drink. It was no drugs. I can't remember drugs till the 70s, but there were probably a lot of alcoholics, baseball-wise,
sure,
back in the 50s, and no one really thought too much about it, or no one called it to their attention, and not knowing how much guys drank, but there were a lot of players who, I'm certain, you know, abused themselves, and I think in today's game, you're liable to see players go out of their way to make corner certain players that they think are not taking care of themselves, more so back in the old days. The old days, it was we just didn't think much about it. I mean, I can recall now, looking back on it, I know a lot of guys who I probably think, well, those guys were alcoholics at that time, and no one ever really realized it. But I think the players today are more in tune with what's going on. And when they see guys not taking care of themselves and the fact that it might cost them a game, might cost them a championship, you see guys that corner other guys and say, look, this has got to stop. You're costing me money, and this is the way it's got to be. So, but back in the 50s and 60s, I don't think you had, you didn't see a lot of guys talking to other guys about what they were doing off the field.
And the managers wouldn't have said anything either, would they?
No.
I mean, in your generation, the Richards and the Weavers would have just let it happen. And
yeah, I think that the you're right. The Weavers and the but performance-wise, I mean, if it took away something from the performance, those guys would have been right on top of it too, I'm sure. You know, Weaver, I always appreciated Weaver, and because here's a guy who never wanted to do anything his whole life except be a professional big league player, and never had the ability to do it. He grew up in St. Louis and signed with the Cardinals, and he went back to the minor leagues, started at the bottom managing, and worked his way up to the major leagues and in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But as I say, Earl, he made every player feel important, and I think that's what a manager's got to do, because you only play nine at a time, but you got to keep those other guys knowing what their jobs are, knowing when they're going to be called on to do it, and utilize everyone. He did a good job of that. You can't let guys sit for a week or 2 weeks. You got to get them in the flow of things. You got to get them in the game and make them feel a part of the team, and I think that's what Earl did. We used to play Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, and then we'd have a Sunday day game. Well, invariably, Earl would put out the funkiest looking lineup you've ever seen. You know, Tom Chope on our team, or he'd be playing against Nolan Ryan. And we'd have these Sunday games, but everyone got to play. And that was really the kind of the key, I think, to Earl.
Now, did he follow Hank Bauer?
Earl Fowler and Hank Bauer, and okay. I think all of us knew it was just a matter of time because Harry Dalton, who was a general manager in Baltimore, signed Earl Weaver to manage in the minor leagues. And then when Harry Dalton became the general manager, everyone said, well, it's just a matter of time till Earl gets here. And consequently, we didn't play well in 67. And then at All-Star Game of 68, Harry Dalton made the change and Earl got the job. I think Earl was coaching then, too. Coaching the Orioles, but he got the job in 68 and almost caught the Tigers that year.
Dalton gets a lot of credit for the Orioles in those years because he was considered to be a very bright, smart guy.
Yeah, Harry Dalton did an outstanding job. You're absolutely right, and went on to California and to Milwaukee too, I guess. But Harry made the change and as I said, Earl went on to have four or five great years in a row, and then we got in the World Series, and then 73 and 74, we won the division and lost to Oakland in the playoffs, and then he came back in, 84, I guess, after he retired. Well, he went to the World Series in 79, and then 84, he retired and came back in 70, and 80. Let's see, 80, I'm not sure, 82, I guess, almost won, and then
Joe Altobelli.
Altobelli took over and won the World Championship in 83.
I was just going to say, if Hank Bauer was a marshmallow, what would be the appropriate food group for Earl?
For Earl? Well, I tell you what, Earl, I can honestly tell you, he gave me more laughs than anyone that I ever played with or ever been around in the game. I mean, it just... to watch him and his antics during the game. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, we'd get to a ninth inning or the bottom of the ninth, and we need one out or one pitch away from winning, and he'd go down in the what we call the hole there. He didn't want to see the outcome of the pitch, you know. He wanted to listen to the crowd to see if Palmer got him out or not. But just things like that. I saw him. Had a episode in Cleveland. He's always been one of those guys who picks up second base and runs off the field with it. They talk about him running in the opponent's dugout and they had a fight and they pitched him back out on the field. And I saw him, we were playing in Cleveland and they had a balk or something like that. But here comes Earl and, oh, he's arguing and all of a sudden, bang, he's gone back through the dugout, down through the in Cleveland, and I don't know where he went, but he went to the clubhouse, he got the rule book and came back out, and he's running. He said, this is it, you know, and the umpires are shaking their head. Finally, he just takes a rule book and he tears it up and just pitches it up in the air and said, well, you know, we're not going to play by the rules. We don't need this book. But I tell you, the thing that the umpires, he gave the umpires a hard time, but they really respected him because, I'll tell you, he knew the rule book better than they did. Yeah. And they respected him for that. But
he was certainly famous with the umpires. Nick Bremigan, for some reason, Nick Bremigan and Weaver just couldn't get along. And I remember watching them with Bremigan. Wherever Bremigan was, he'd find them.
Yeah.
I want to go back, though, to the economics because, again, the people watching this a long time from now won't realize that when you played, everybody played year by year.
Yeah.
Contract by contract, no long-term contracts. So pick 1966. I mean, you had a great year. Talk about the process. The season's over.
Well, I signed 23 one-year contracts. Yeah. I mean, that's just the way they operated.
And
the Orioles never gave a two-year contract to anyone. I signed 23-year one-year. And so you know who had the advantage. I mean, the general manager, he was a professional in negotiating, and they always had the answers. And I remember that Lee McPhail was there, and Lee McPhail is the most wonderful guy in the whole world. In fact, when I see Lee McPhail right now, he almost cries that what he, you know, the way he operated when we were playing. And I remember talking to Lee McPhail, and he was saying, well, Brooks, I mean, I was a general manager with the Yankees, and I didn't pay Mickey Mantle that much money in his third year, you know, and I'm saying, well, I don't care about Mickey Mantle, you know. And he said, well, I couldn't give you more than Mickey Mantle got, you know. And to tell one little more story here, but I held out for a whole week in Florida for $500. And you know that the players are always, I mean, the owners weren't that smart because they didn't know that we'd have played for nothing, you know. But anyway, we got them to that point. But we went to Florida. You're always anxious to get to Florida, get the spring training. You're taking the kids out of school, putting them in school there maybe. But I went down without being signed, but I held out for a whole week. And finally, Harry Dalton called. He said, well, we got to get this thing straightened out. Come on in now, you know, and sit down here and talk to me. And so I went over, and this is the Miami Stadium, and I went in and sat down just like this. And I said, Harry, I deserve $500 more. And, you know, me being a outstanding defensive player, I mean, that doesn't mean anything. It's just, well, how many hits did you get? How many home runs? Defense was way in the background. But anyway, Harry said, well, I just can't pay you that. I said, Harry, I deserve it. He said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He said, I'm going to leave the room for 10 minutes, and you sit here and you think about it. And when I come back, we'll make the decision. So he left the room, and I'm sitting there just waiting on him to come back. And finally, Harry comes back, and he said, well, how do you feel? I said, Harry, I deserve the $500. You know? He said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He said, I'm going to give you that $500. He said, but just remember, when we negotiate next year, you took advantage of me this year, you know. So he made you feel about that. And I don't let Harry forget that. When I talked to him, I said, Harry, you remember that day I held out, that week I held out for $500? And he feels bad about it, too, after he's seen what happened in the game of baseball.
And Brooks, would you be comfortable telling us what the highest?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I started making $100,000 after the 70 World Series, and the most I ever made was like $130,000, and that was in 76. And then the last year, I was player coach in 77, and the Orioles said, well, you know, you're player coach. Anybody can be a player coach. We're going to give you we're going to cut you to $60,000 or $70,000, That's when Marvin Miller, who was the head of the Players Association, said, well, you can only take a 25% cut. So anyway, I ended up playing for $100,000 that year. That was the last year I was a player coach that year. But I made $127,000. But I don't think there were, you know, in 77, probably wouldn't, I don't know if anyone would be making $200,000.
No. Mm-hmm.
That would have been the max probably.
No, I think
then.
That's right.
But anyway, It was a battle, and my wife, God bless her soul, she always thought that, well, you deserve more, you know, you should get more. And I wish I'd have been a little more hard-headed. I always see Dave McNally, one of my favorite pitchers, one of my favorite people, and also a great pitcher. Dave was one of those guys that he just went in and he said, well, I'm not signing till I get this, you know. And he was, but the rest of us, we kind of gave in, and we wanted to play and wanted to get to spring training. And Dave said, no, I'm not signing. In fact, Dave was, you know, with Messerschmitt, those one of the guys that right. became the first players in the history of the
right.
game not
right.
to sign a contract. Yeah. And they tried to offer him more money later on to sign, but he said, I'm not signing, the heck with it. So, but anyway, that's another story.
Well, not to say that the Orioles were cheap, but is there a truth to the story that when an outfielder was hurt, crashing into the brick walls at Memorial Stadium, the outfielders demanded padding, which they received, but they were sent the bill.
I don't know. I haven't heard that story.
Don Baylor told me that.
Don
they were asked to split up the bill for the padding on the wall.
For the padding, huh?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's a whole different game
Brooks,
now,
you,
I suppose.
Yeah. Did you have jobs in the off season?
Did I have jobs? Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, when the season was over, I got married in 1960, and when the season was over, I looked for a job. I worked for a fellow named Larry Willis, I believe. He had a process called Martin hard coating. They put on the bottom of skis at one time, and I worked for him doing some public relations work, and then went to work for the Orioles during the winter. I'd go to about five or six banquets a week for $25 a banquet is what it was, I believe. And so I did have a little job during the winter time, and that was what I was concerned about more than anything else. And I went back to, well, early in my career, I played winter baseball 2 years, but also went back to college 2 years too. But I was looking for a job, yeah.
Now, in your generation, in the off season, you weren't as physically, you weren't as compulsive about fitness, but you obviously stayed in shape and took care of yourself. What would you do in the off season? Did you play basketball or handball or How did you stay in shape?
Well, the off season, I think the way the players stayed in shape, we had a Oriole basketball team that played probably 15 to 20 games a year, did a little running, never lifted a weight in my whole life, and probably I wish that I was on the bus one day when I was doing the television games, and I looked at Scott McGregor, a pitcher, and I said, you know, I wish I'd have just got into some program, a Nautilus program, when I was in my early 30s. I could have probably played longer, you know. And he started laughing. He said, well, I mean, you played almost 23 years. How long do you want to play? You almost, you know, you're in the Hall of Fame. What more do you want? And But it was a little taboo almost when you for players sure. to lift weights or something. But there's no doubt in my mind that that players today are bigger and stronger and they do the right things and they keep in a lot, you know, I think better shape than we were. We went to spring training to get in shape, and when they come to spring training now, most of them have really worked out all winter and are in much better physical condition. I think baseball players are probably the worst conditioned athletes of all the major sports. But as far as lifting weights, we just, it was kind of drilled into our brain that, hey, you can get, you know, you can get muscle bound, but like how you'd have to lift weights your whole life to get muscle bound almost. So you really do need a program to keep you fit, I think. Because I lost it, hey, when I was I was the oldest guy in the league when I retired. I was 40 years old, and I could still catch the ball and throw guys out. But where you lose it, you just lose it strength-wise. You hit the ball and it doesn't go as far. You just don't have that speed to get through there, you know. Mm. And that was where I lost it. So when you're hitting left, well, it was all over for me.
Brooks, you mentioned the basketball team in the offseason, staying together. The Orioles were as noted for their familial attitude, friends off and on the field, sticking together, Frank's kangaroo court. It's helped set you aside from the 25 Cavs for 25 different Red Sox yeah. attitude. Could you talk about the closeness of those teams and what that kangaroo court did? It was the first one, I believe.
Well, you know, we were close. I mean, Frank, he came over and after he saw how great, you know, these guys were, I mean, he just really fell in line and we fell in love with him too. And one of the things we did during the season and the preseasons were we had this kangaroo court. You know, he had an old mop and he took the put it over his head here. He was the judge and we had three or four different awards. We had a base running award for I can't think of the fellow's name, but he was the most atrocious base runner in Oriole history. We had an old shoe that we gave, you know, away. We had a whoever had the weakest swing that night. You might break a bat or something, and it dribbles to the pitcher. We had a weak swing award. We had three or four awards that we had passed out, and we only did this after we won. We didn't do it when we lost, but when we won, we'd have a kangaroo court, and they would fan guys for saying crazy things or palling around with the other team or looking up the scoreboard and saying, well, I thought, you know, there's two outs and there was only one. Or, I mean, just crazy things. You'd bring it up. And, of course, we kept these fines. And then I think we donated them to charity when the season was over. I don't know how much money. It wasn't a lot of money. But every time we won, you had this kangaroo court. And it lasted about 15 minutes. And then we got a lot of laughs. I mean, it really was a good thing to bring the team together. And we had a group of guys who really like one another, which I think is important. And, you know, even the Yankees today, I mean, Joe Torres, for my sake, doesn't get enough credit. He's one of those guys who, when those guys come through that door, they just check their ego. And they pull for one another, they like one another. And I think that's been a key to the Yankees winning ball games because I certainly see that in team. Not all, it doesn't happen all the time. You look at the great Oakland team, 72, 3, and 4, these guys were fighting all the time, but that's kind of a once happening, I guess. But most of the time, you see teams that really like one another. I think it's a big plus. And our guys, I still see these guys, and we, you know, Paul Blair's in Baltimore, and I see Frank around, and of course, Boog's there all the time, and we had a good group of guys.
Could you go position by position and talk about those guys?
Yeah, sure. Well, Boog Powell, he's the only guy I never won a Gold Glove on our team, and he never let us forget it. Every time we'd make a bad throw, he'd come in and he'd mark it up on the wall there, you know. When the season was over, he'd say, well, I only saved you 15 errors, Brooks, by those short hops you threw me over there. But Boog was a great target to throw to. Had a great pair of hands, and they always boo the big guys. They don't give the big guys enough credit a lot of time, but Boog was outstanding. And of course, we had Davy Johnson, who came. That was his rookie year in '66, and Davy won some Gold Gloves. And we had Aparicio, a shortstop. He came over in '64 in a trade, I believe, with the White Sox. We sent Hoyt Wilhelm over there and Ronnie Hanson. This was '63 or '64, but Louis was there. And I just, you know, we talk about Mark Belanger, the great fielder he was, and I just have to. I have a hard time separating those guys. They were so great. I mean, they just. The routine ground ball was an out, and that's really what you want from your shortstop, is just make the routine plays every time they hit it to you, because you're going to get more ground balls than anyone else. And those guys did it as good as you could do it. And Louis was there 64, 5, 6, and 67. I think he got traded, and Belanger took over that year, and Belanger was automatic too. And then I was at third, and we had Blair in center field, who was just as good an outfielder as you'll ever want to see. I mean, I put him. I'm a little prejudiced because I've played with these guys and see them day in and day out. But he could do it as good as anyone.
I'm going to interrupt you, but I asked DiMaggio to rate center fielders after he played, and he rated Blair right up there.
Really?
Yeah, he said he called him the kid in Baltimore.
Yeah.
But he said he was a terrific ball player.
He was. He
so that's really high praise coming from DiMaggio.
Yeah, and Paul was really came into his own offensively. He hit 20-something home runs, and then he got beaned worse than anyone I ever seen get hit. Mm-hmm. As a pitcher named Tatum at California Angels hit him right here, or right here, you know, and just he was never the same after that. But, boy, what a... outfielder he was. So we had the pitching, we had the defense and the offense and the pitching. In '66 we had a 15 game winner, but that was about it.
Okay.
But then you go on and start getting Cuellar and Palmer and McNally going out there every 4 days. You don't have to be too good to win a lot of games.
Did you get a kick out of the interaction between Palmer and Weaver? And Weaver and Johnson, Davy Johnson, had their moments too.
Yeah, but basically Palmer and Weaver, they were always at odds. I mean, it's unbelievable. They gave us a lot of laughs. And it's one of those love-hate relationships. Palmer would, they'd be yelling at one another, and the next day they'd be playing golf, you know, and it's one of those things. And this is